This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, as per usual, by my friend, my colleague, my co-monster fighter, my fellow goonie, the lieutenant of Megaforce. He's writing Doctor Strange. He's C. Robert Cargill.
Up in the JFC!
What up?
What?
We have got a hell of a show on tap for you today. Here in this election season, we are putting two titans against each other to finally settle for good and all this epic battle. But first, I want to remind you that pretty much everything we do is epic, and if you would like to prove that for yourself, you can go back and listen to our back catalog of episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher.
Episodes, as we call them.
Holy shit, Cargill just made a pun, you guys. Boop, 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 boop. That's awesome. Episodes.
We're in really, really in odd moods this week. It's
we
very
are.
Strange.
We are indeed.
We're in rare form.
Rare form indeed. But yeah, you can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Now, yes, we've alluded to an epic battle, a question that has been perplexing film fans for many years, and especially film fans who are entering a certain age that in their youth, they saw two movies only 2 years apart. They saw one movie, one film in 1985, one film in 1987. These films are remarkably alike in structure, remarkably alike in what it is, the elements that we glean from them that we have attached to, and yet could not be more divisive in terms of the camps of fans that they have. And the question keeps ringing out, which film is better, 1985's The Goonies or 1987's Monster Squad?
You know who to call when you have ghosts. But who do you call when you have monsters?
We're the Monster Squad.
They call themselves the Goonies.
They're young and inexperienced. They're a bit disorganized.
They've stumbled onto a legend. But they're not alone.
But when strange things start happening in town, they're the only ones ready to do battle.
Discover what they uncover.
Sounds like Kong.
Maybe we can be like Mask Squad and Stygia. Two mask bombs.
Now, I will admit, this is a rivalry I wasn't even aware of until I moved to Austin. But have since grown to understand that the people who like Monster Squad, prefer Monster Squad, are very vehement about it, and the people that prefer Goonies just absolutely think there is no question that Goonies is the better film. And we thought, what better way to decide this than to sit down and break it down piece by piece, look at the elements that both films have to see which film does each one better.
If nothing tells you what kind of a town Austin is, it's that one of our biggest problems is that we can't settle a debate between the Goonies and the Monster Squad.
This is nerd world problems that we are having in Austin, Texas, is what Cargill is trying to say, and he is absolutely right. Life is so good here that we have to come to blows over whether Monster Squad or Goonies is the superior film. But I am proud to be a part of that battle. And I want to commend you guys for being a part of that battle. I asked on Facebook and on Twitter, and the responses, Cargill, were as varied as they were vehement. I mean, we have J.R. Blanco, who said he's Team Monster Squad solely due to the fact that they featured perhaps one of the best werewolves on film. We have Leon Collins, who says he's Team Goonies because he loved the film as a kid, loves it in his adult, and loved introducing it to his two children. We have just so many responses.
Did you do a poll?
I did a poll on Facebook.
What was the poll percentage?
Split almost right down the middle. If it leans either way, it's slightly more in the Goonies camp. But I'm telling you, between Facebook and Twitter, as many, almost exactly as many responses for Monster Squad as there were for Goonies, which further proves the point that this question needs to be decided. So let's take a look at these two movies as they are. Now, I don't need to do much setup in terms of Goonies. I think everyone pretty much understands the plot. We have a family in Astoria who are about to be forced to sell their home, and the young boy of the family, Mikey, has a group of friends, a group of little outsiders that are known as the Goonies because they live in the part of town known as the Goondocks. And they discover a treasure map in their attic, their dad holding over some relics from a local museum, and they find a treasure map belonging to a local legend, a local pirate legend by the name of One-Eyed Willie. My first question, however, for this film, it is said during the prologue or during the expositional part of the film that One-Eyed Willie was, in like with the 1600s, was running from the British, managed to escape into a cave only to be caved in by the British cannons. Okay. Astoria is in what state? In Oregon, which would put it on the West Coast in the 1600s. What would a Spanish pirate be doing on the West Coast of the United States in the 1600s?
All sorts of things. I mean, like,
well, there you have it, folks.
What would he be doing? Well, it's...
It just, when you think of the realms that, oh, it is in Oregon. Okay, yeah. Then my question is, it remains. Maybe I just think about pirates. I think about them being in the Caribbean, in, you know, the Atlantic Ocean between America and Spain. I don't know what a pirate ship would be doing on the other side of a country that hasn't even been explored
yet. It's just, he's a much more liberal pirate.
I guess so.
He's
a left coast pirate.
He's just one of those freedom-loving, liberal West Coast pirates.
He's a West Coast pirate.
He's a Bernie voter, you know, he's...
Sure. Feel the Willie burn, sure.
Yeah, One-Eyed Willie lives in Bernie country.
Feel the burn and touch my Willie, I believe, was when they ran together on the same ticket.
One-Eyed Willie is not a euphemism. That is definitely not an in-joke that parents got, that kids didn't get. Well, not a thing that happened.
All of the kids in this movie say his name with so much enthusiasm all the time. I'm like, oh, One-Eyed Willie! And I'm like, oh my God, they really have to stop doing that, because as a grown-up, that means something different than when I watched this movie so many times as a kid. But this leads them on an adventure, gets to be, you know, a treasure hunting adventure, then a swashbuckling adventure. There you have the Goonies. I mean, pretty much everyone has seen the Goonies.
It's essentially the greatest Dungeons & Dragons movie ever made that nobody ever gives credit for being a Dungeons & Dragons movie. You have all your major class archetypes going into a dungeon, solving all these traps, ultimately getting into a final fight with the boss, and then sailing off with treasure. Like, it is straight up Dungeons & Dragons.
Yep. And then on the other side, we have The Monster Squad, 1987, which is a film about, again, a group of kids who are somewhat outcast themselves. They've formed their own little group that they call The Monster Squad because they are kind of obsessed with horror movies and all things monstrous.
They're the Monster Club.
You're right. They're the Monster Club.
And then when shit gets real, they become The Monster Squad.
That's when they mobilize and take up those Second Amendment rights we've been hearing so much about and actually fight back against what is essentially a cadre of universal monsters.
The right to wear arms.
Yes, exactly. The right to have hair on your balls.
Nards.
Nards. On your nards, indeed. When Count Dracula begins to bring to life all of the, you know, the Frankenstein's monster, the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Universal monsters.
The universal monsters themselves. It falls upon this group of very young but very knowledgeable of monsters kids to strike back against the forces of evil. Those are the two films. Goonies, undeniably the more popular film, and I mean that in terms of how many people have seen it, how easy it was to obtain for a long time, and just sheer box office. I mean, you're talking about the Goonies racking up about $61 million in 85, Monster Squad only $3.7 million in 87. So, but I mean, that's understandable considering our first category against which we're going to judge these two movies, which is the creators behind them. I'm going to stack these two movies up and look at who are the people behind the scenes responsible for these two movies. And when you look at The Goonies, the reason it's the more popular film, the film that's been seen by more people, is not hard to figure out.
No.
I mean, it's directed by Richard Donner.
Yep.
You know, of Superman, for fuck's sake.
And The Omen.
And The Omen.
At this point.
And a number of truly amazing films. And behind that, you have producers like Kathleen Kennedy, and oh, I don't know, Steven Spielberg?
Yeah, and then the writer of the film is a guy named Chris Columbus, who at the time had written Gremlins.
Yes, and there there is actually a number of Gremlins references in the film.
Oh, yeah.
There's one point where Chunk, as he is called, one of the probably more notable characters of the film, one of the more memorable characters of the film, is calling the police, and it's clear that he is a bit of a storyteller, and the police don't initially believe him. Is that you, Lawrence? His real name is Lawrence. And the police, the sheriff actually says, what about the time you told me about all those little animals that multiply when you throw water on them? And it's like, that sounds familiar. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about before we got into get into comparing these.
Oh, sure, sure.
One of the reasons we're talking about this is because they share so much in common.
Oh my gosh!
Like a
so
disturbing
much.
Amount of in common, because these films exist in this small window of the 80s when you have some filmmakers who are trying to get away with murder, sometimes literally in family films.
Yes,
and Spielberg at the time was notorious for this. So you have two stories about large collections of kids who all fit certain archetypes going on this adventure, all of them swearing,
mm-hmm.
talking about sex. They each have a big monstrous friend in the film.
True.
Who can
barely talk.
Who can barely talk. And they ultimately... end up with this big, huge, fuck-all climax battle. And these films, literally, you know, watching them side by side, they are, to a certain extent, the same movie.
Very, very, very similar.
In the best way.
Yeah.
In the best way, not in a... because Monster Squad is not a facsimile of Goonies. And
no.
In fact, it's doing something else with the Goonies model. And we'll get into that as we talk about the differences. But the thing about these films is just, and right down to the language, like, you don't find other family films where the kids swear like this.
Yeah.
Where sex is a running gag in the film. Where the films deal with violence, where people die in these family films.
Yeah.
Like, there are real murders in these movies, and it's crazy. Just how much they are so similar, and yet you can watch them back to back without feeling like, oh my God, it's this all over again. It's a different iteration of the same model.
And to your point, the word shit or bullshit is spoken 19 times in Goonies alone. So yeah, this is a time when I feel like there was more. It's funny because you're right. On a certain scale, they're trying to get away with murder in family films. But in another sense, in both of these movies, it falls upon the youth to actually be the one to resolve the conflict.
Yeah.
And the adults are almost completely out of the picture, marginalized entirely.
Because the adults don't believe.
Because the adults don't believe. And therefore, by having these kids speak more like adults, and that does unfortunately include more expletives, what you're actually doing as a storyteller is you're trusting your youthful characters to be, if you're trusting them with adult responsibilities, like, you know, protecting the world or being the ones to save the family farm or whatever it may be, you're entrusting them with an adult level of responsibility. So you are instilling in them your giving to them the ability to speak like adults as well, almost as an acknowledgement of the fact that they are having this hefty adult responsibility thrust upon their shoulders, because in these movies, and there are so many of them in the 80s, adults are almost completely out of the picture.
Oh yeah.
And it actually reminded me a lot when we watch movies like Attack the Block, and why Attack the Block blew us away so much, and why we talk so much about how it feels like an 80s movie. That's one of the biggest elements, is that it once again falls upon this group of kids who talk like adults, who have their own little group, their fictive kin network, to deal with the supernatural threat, because the adults are almost completely absent. And that's a lot of trust. I mean, not only from a storytelling perspective to trust these characters, but also to trust the actors involved, to trust these young actors with, you know, carrying an entire movie. And so I think this was why this feels so much like the golden age of kids movies, is because, and why they're so rewatchable even as we're adults, is because it's an adult level of responsibility. It's an adult level of trust that the filmmaker, the writer is putting upon the characters, and the director is putting upon the cast. And these two movies have pretty outstanding casts in that regard. Obviously, we'll get into cast in a second, but let's go back for just a moment and finish off our conversation about the creators. We've already talked a lot about the myriad of amazing people behind Goonies.
Oh, yeah.
Behind the scenes.
Well, it is part of that Spielbergian Amblin era when Amblin was, you know, Amblin.
Yes.
And it is, yeah, it is the creators behind that. It's fantastic. However,
on the flip side, for Monster Squad, we have a returning JFC alum, the director of Night of the Creeps, Mr. Fred Decker.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I'll be real honest. I love Fred Decker to death. But obviously, again, the reason why so many more people have seen Goonies than Monster Squad is Fred Decker versus Richard Donner. I mean, yeah, one of those two guys has had a historic, established career in Hollywood. And one of those guys made a number of really great films and then unfortunately had his entire career derailed by one flop. And that was it. And it's a sad story. We talked a lot about it on Night of the Creeps. You can go back to that episode and listen to more of that. But writing the movie along with Fred Decker is a guy who all throughout his life has been a Hollywood powerhouse. From the time he was about, what, 19, 20 some years old?
Yeah, he was a young kid from USC, you know, that just exploded onto the scene with a whole bunch of scripts. And
the first one he sold being?
Lethal Weapon.
Lethal fucking Weapon, which if I remember my history correctly, he sold when he was what, 20, I want to say 22, 23 years old?
He was pretty young when that happened.
Insane. And then goes on to write a number of great films like Last Boy Scout, The Long Kiss Goodnight, goes on to make his feature film directing debut with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in 2005, which is an absolutely phenomenal film, and then directs Iron Man 3. Which is a Marvel film that I really love. I know that movie's kind of divisive in and of itself, but I love Iron Man 3. And yeah, and we're talking about Shane Black.
Yeah.
Shane Black, who also, I believe, is, isn't he one of the writers on Predator as well?
No, I think he did some polish on Predator. He's in Predator.
Oh, that's right. Yes,
he's
he
the
plays
guy
one
who
of the
tells
in
the pussy print. Joke.
That's right.
because he was good friends with John McTiernan at the time, and McTiernan would put him in the films. He also appears in Hunt for October. He's always around in that era.
That's why I was getting.
And he's also somebody who comes and hangs out in Austin once a year. So a lot of people around town know him. I've known him for a long time. Super fucking talented guy. Just crazy talented. And it's so weird because it's we're comparing Richard Donner to Fred Decker. And it's like, yeah, but we're comparing Shane Black to Chris Columbus.
Yeah.
One of whom wrote one of the greatest monster movies of all time and then directed a whole series of bizarre train wrecks.
Yeah.
And made what is arguably the two worst Harry Potter films ever.
The first two, yeah.
And the ones that anger the fans the most.
This is true. So, I mean, in this regard, in this particular category, it's almost a complete push, in my opinion. Like, the one thing that would push Goonies over the edge here, I believe, is the powerhouse of producers behind it, being Kathleen Kennedy and Steven Spielberg. And from what I've read, doing my research, a lot of the younger cast, when they were interviewed, when they were still kids, talked about Spielberg in a co-director capacity more than just a guy who produced the movie. Like, he was very hands-on, which isn't surprising when you think about all the rumors swirling around movies like Poltergeist as well.
Yeah.
So that doesn't surprise me. And I feel like because of that, if there's an edge in this category, the edge is Spielberg, because you're right. I mean, the directing, the better directing as far as the establishment of the director. And I want to make this very clear, however. I think Fred Decker has a type of film that he does, and he does that film tremendously well. And I don't think that you could point to anything, and Cargill, feel free to correct me if you don't agree, but I don't think you could point to anything in Richard Donner's oeuvre and be like, this is, and then look at the way Fred Decker directs and point to something and say, okay, that is proof that Richard Donner is a better director because of technical merit X, Y, or Z versus, you know, directing what he directs. For, I mean, if you compare the apples and the oranges correctly, I feel like that is, it's a pretty close race to call.
It is, although I would say at the end of the day, the difference between Donner and Decker is that Donner was somebody who is always kind of pushing the boundaries of trying to make something new. Mm-hmm. You look at his three greatest films, which are arguably the ones we've mentioned: The Omen, Superman, and or if you want to say Superman 2. Personally, I'm one of those guys who like Superman 2 more than Superman, but I think they're both amazing.
Yeah.
And Goonies. None of those films are alike. They're all. You know, they're all something very different and very special, and define the genre that they exist in. Mm-hmm. Decker, on the other hand, is a reflection of the cinema world. His films are about nostalgia.
Yeah, and that's actually the point I was going to make in sort of counter to yours, was that if you look at these two films, Monster Squad and Goonies, one of the other things that they share is that they are both very nostalgic films.
Mm-hmm.
They are nostalgic about different things. Decker, very nostalgic for the Universal Monster movies, obviously. Goonies is very nostalgic for Errol Flynn films. It's very nostalgic for a lot of the swashbuckling cinema of the 1930s and 40s. And honestly, I think it's nostalgic already for Raiders of the Lost Ark. Because there's so much about this movie to me, with all of the, we'll get to this in a second, but with all of its machinations, that feels like if you took the opening scene of Raiders, where he's trying to avoid all the traps in the cave to get the idol, and you extrapolated that out to where the entire movie took place in that cave, that's kind of what Goonies feels like to me.
Yeah.
You replace Indiana Jones with a bunch of foul-mouthed kids, and you stretch the entire movie to take place in that cave in the beginning. That is what Goonies feels like, which is not surprising considering Spielberg is on board, is a part, his DNA is all over this movie. But my point is, I feel like nostalgia is the key to understanding both of, it's like that skull key that they got from Chester Cobblepot. It's the key to understanding both of these movies. And so you are correct in that, in if you look at the overall career of Richard Donner, there is more envelope pushing. But one of the interesting things about comparing them as directors when comparing these two films is that both of these films rely heavily on nostalgia.
Right. But Donner, he focuses, I say Donner, I think this is more Spielberg than Donner, because Spielberg's films in the Amblin era during these years are all very nostalgic. They feel like they want to exist in the 50s,
yes,
but with an 80s aesthetic.
Yes.
That there's a wholesomeness to the family unit, even juxtaposed against Spielberbia, which we watched develop. Nice. Whereas Donner, this, you know, both of these two films that he did back to back, as we mentioned in the previous episode, Night of the Creeps, which is made,
Decker, yeah.
Night of the Creeps, which is made a year before The Monster Squad, has a scene in a toilet where somebody's written The Monster Squad on the wall. Like, clearly they're prepping that movie and they're very excited about it. But both of his films back to back there are about his love of cinema. Mm-hmm. And about his love of movies. And these kids are in love with these movies, and the movie is in love with these movies, and there's a very visceral thing that you can pull out and identify exactly what he's nostalgic for. You're absolutely right that Goonies is a nostalgic film, but I feel like it's more nostalgic for a time gone by, mm-hmm, rather than this movie is very much trying to be an Errol Flynn film, or this film is trying to be this kind of a movie. It's a new kind of adventure film playing around with all these ideas cobbled from all over the place that isn't one particular genre. Like, Monster Squad is Universal Monsters. Like, that is, it's kids versus Universal Monsters. It is practically Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein,
yes,
or meets the Wolfman. Like, it is,
or meets that, all of them.
Yeah. It's Abbott and Costello meet all of them, except Abbott and Costello are a bunch of kids. And it actually plays in the same vein as those movies did, because those movies mixed comedy with seriousness.
I mean, the character of Chunk, basically every time he runs up against something bad, is just like... like very much an overdrawn Abbott and Costello type reaction. So yeah, no, I think there's that element exists in both the movies as well.
And that character is repeated in Fat Kid.
Yes.
Horace.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, they're definitely the, you know, they're the replacement for that character. So yeah.
Yeah. And if we've looked at the creators, if we look at the cast, this is an area where I think, unfortunately, the Goonies has it all over Monster Squad, but that's not to the detriment of Monster Squad. It's just that Monster Squad gets a lot of great performances out of a lot of unknowns, whereas...
And then has a junk food favorite.
John Grease.
John Grease as the Wolfman.
Of course. And Tom Noonan as the Frankenstein's monster. But you go beyond those two, and you really kind of grasping at straws to find anyone else that you would recognize from anything else.
Sean Astin is like the...
And then you have Sean Astin in Goonies. Now, it's unfortunately apropos that we're talking about these movies this week, because unfortunately Sean Astin's mother, Patty Duke, just passed away, which I actually didn't know.
I didn't know they were related.
Yeah, Patty Duke was married to John Astin. From the Addams Family.
Oh yeah,
and
Return of the Killer Tomatoes, which he is best known for
on this show for sure. And their son is Sean Astin, who plays Mikey. Now, Sean Astin still very early in his career. This is obviously pre-Rudy, but someone who, like his brother in the film, Josh Brolin, goes on. You know, these are two established names now who were right at the beginning of their careers. Both seem like they've been in movies for many years before they show up in Goonies. I mean, they're both so skilled, way beyond their years. A lot of charisma right there on the screen early on. And then, of course, rounding out their group, you have Corey Feldman, who actually beat out a friend of his for the role, Corey Haim. This is the audition for
the
this
Corys.
Movie. The audition for this movie gave us the Corys, because that's how they became friends. Interesting side note.
Oh, what a sad, sad, tragic story that is.
Indeed. And then, again, going back to the Spielberg just kind of all over this movie, Data, the quirky inventor Asian kid played by Jonathan K. Kwan, who was also Short Round in Temple of Doom. So, I mean, and that's just the kids. I mean, on top of that, you've got Robert fucking Davi, one of the Agent Johnsons from Die Hard, amongst a number of other films, and Joe Pantoliano, Joey Pants, playing the Fratelli brothers, and then Anne Ramsey of Throw Mama from the Train as their mother. I mean, the cast is absolutely exceptional in the Goonies, both at the young cast and some of the adults in the movie. And I feel like this is one category where Goonies has it just in terms of the name factor. However, their performances in Monster Squad with relative unknowns or complete unknowns as their young actors is remarkable. And feels to me every bit as realized, every bit as authentic, and every bit as fun as the performances. And by that I mean, you get the sense that these kids really are friends. You get the sense that these kids aren't just reading lines in a script. The words coming out of their mouths feel like they existed there before the scene started. Do the truffle shuffle, exactly. Or, you know, Wolfman's Got Nards, or like... You know, the bogus, and you know, all of the things that they're saying to each other, all the conversations they're having, don't feel like they were scripted by someone much older than them. It feels very authentic to how kids would interact, and maybe a little bit more dangerously authentic than a lot of kids' films up to that point would have acknowledged, as we talked about before. So I think that while we have more established names in Goonies that may give it the edge there, I don't think there's a huge discrepancy in the performance level between these two casts.
No, but I think what puts Goonies over the edge here is the fact that there are many more dynamics at work in the Goonies than there are Monster Squad.
I would agree with that.
Now, let me put a caveat in here in Monster Squad's defense. Monster Squad is credited as having been written by Shane and Fred Decker. Mm-hmm. However, they didn't write it together. What happened was Shane wrote the script, and then Fred Decker cut about 30 pages out of the script and then sewed it all together. There is a much longer version floating around out there. When I found out about this, Shane promised he would get me a copy. And every year when we'd see each other at Austin Film Festival, he's like, I can't find that script, but I'm going to find it. And like about 4 years in, he's like, yeah, dude, I'm never finding that script. Like, I don't think I have a copy anymore. I thought I did. Every time I come to Austin, I look for it and I can't find. So somewhere out there, I'm sure there's a draft of Monster Squad lying around, of his original, I guess, 120 page script. But so in that getting chopped down, what he said was there's more to the characters, but there's a lot more about the monsters in there.
Yeah.
In the Goonies, you have some really great interpersonal relationships. Not only are the characters really defined, but you have characters with crushes. You have characters who are in relationships with one another. You have different characters are closer friends with each other and bond with each other in different ways. You've got the older brother, younger brother dynamic, all of this going on where you don't have that as much in Goonies or in Monster Squad. In Monster Squad, what you have instead is an odd collection of kids that range from 5 years old up to a 13-year-old who smokes and rides a bike. And
maybe the coolest fucking kid in any 80s movie ever.
Clearly the slickest kid ever. You know, he's hitting on, you know, a 17-year-old girl. He's smoking cigarettes. He puts down a bully in one of my favorite Save the Cat scenes of all time.
Oh, for sure. By the way, that bully, played by Jason Hervey, who was Kevin's older brother on The Wonder Years,
yeah,
tries to make Horace, who they call Fat Kid, eat a candy bar that he's stepped on. Or he steps.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. Yeah, he takes
the
candy bar and he steps on it, and then
rips his comic book. Motherfucker.
Ooh, not cool. Not cool at all. That is the cardinal sin he really commits. And then Rudy shows up and not only tells him to stop picking on him, but makes Jason Hervey eat the fucking candy bar he's just stepped on.
But the beauty of it, and Decker, and this is what is so great about Monster Squad. What's so amazing about it is so much in love with cinema that every single moment it has is rendered perfectly in classic cinema style. So when Rudy shows up, Rudy doesn't just show up. We hear his voice and then we turn and we see a bike. And we track up the bike, and then we see cool shoes and socks and loafers, which does not translate over time. But just assume that at the time this is cool. Rolled up pant leg also does not translate with time. Tracks up, and then we see a match light on the shoe. The match comes up as the camera keeps tracking up. Lights a cigarette. The kid's got fucking Tom Cruise sunglasses dangling on the edge of his nose. And that's how we meet our cool kid character.
Lights a cigarette. That's kind of my favorite juxtaposition of imagery.
He's a 13-year-old
kid. We track
kid.
up a fucking BMX to a kid who then lights a cigarette and looks like fucking Arthur Fonzarelli. And again, like
we're 5 minutes into this movie,
yeah,
and you could not make this movie today.
No.
Like already Fred Decker has made something that can only exist in the 80s. But that's how we meet him. And then he has this perfect save the cat moment where he's just like, I see you've met my friend Horace. You doing okay, Horace? He's like, yeah, I'm doing all right. And then he's like, AJ, you dropped your candy bar. Oh no, that's it. It's yours now.
Eat it.
Eat it, and we'll call it a day. Like, he doesn't even have to threaten the kid.
Which,
he
again,
just says,
is like
eat
the Fonz.
And we'll call it a day. He's just so fucking cool.
There were only like two episodes of Happy Days where the Fonz ever fought anybody, because he didn't fucking have to. Because
he didn't have to.
His reputation preceded him.
And so this character is such the archetype of the cool kid. And then at times, we get to see why he's hanging out with these other kids, because he's the cool kid, but he's not all that cool. He's a nerd who's kind of pretending to be cool. Clearly, you get the impression that at some point he was picked on and isn't picked on anymore. But he's still like bullying an elementary school kid to be the cool kid. Like in any other movie, you'd be like, oh, get this fucking douchebag out of here. But in the Monster Squad, you're like, yeah, Rudy.
For sure. And just one other weird cast element I want to talk about. In The Goonies, there was an actor who plays sort of the son of the rich guy who's also a preppy douchebag. And I kept looking at this actor and going, he looks so familiar. Looks so familiar. Who the hell is that? And then I realized exactly who it was. Now, the character's name in the film is Troy. He's played by an actor named Steve Antin. And I was like, he looks so familiar. I looked it up. Not only is he familiar because it's a movie I've seen, it's a movie that you and I have talked about on this show. He's the third friend from Last American Virgin.
Oh, yeah.
The popular one who knocks her up and then kind of abandons her. The crux of the emotional destruction of the end of that film.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, I mean...
Why did you have to remind me last of it? Now I'm
because
depressed.
We were too happy. We were far
we
too
were
happy.
Way too happy enjoying ourselves, and now we have to think about that depressing but amazing ending.
And I want to talk for a little bit now about the villains of each film, because what we were talking about with Rudy and how he is... He is a cool kid in the 80s. There are 80s elements to him that don't translate. But already there are 50s elements. He's wearing, like I said, the leather jacket, the grease back hair, the cigarette always hanging out of his mouth. He feels very much like a character from the 50s.
Yeah, but of course, this was the era where in this portion of the 80s, there was a big 50s throwback, and that was still cool.
Which is another element that both this film and Goonies share, just by virtue of the fact that Spielberg is involved, and throughout his entire career, as you've already said, huge into the 50s. Huge nostalgic hard-on for the 50s. So we move on from there to the villains of each film. And I'm going to start with The Goonies because in The Goonies, the main antagonist besides real estate developers is this gang of gangsters, the Fratellis.
The Fratellis.
Now, you look at the three of them and the way they're dressed, they look like they're characters out of the 40s. They look like they're gangsters out of the goddamn 40s. They don't look like... you know, like criminals of the 80s. They dress... In fact, I did a little research and it completely made sense that they were based on Ma Barker.
Oh, yeah.
And her boys, the Barker boys. So it's like, okay, so they're kind of going for that. But just by virtue of that, again, we see that sort of nostalgic element coming through. And then, of course, in Monster Squad, as we've already mentioned, we have the Universal Monsters, which I want to talk about for just a second because John Grease plays... possibly, like, I mean, I love the original Wolfman, and, I think Lon Chaney Jr. did an amazing job, but John Grease's Wolfman is pretty fucking outstanding.
Yeah.
He the way he plays it as, when he is in his human form is so frantic. It's almost like a drug addict. It's like, you've got to lock me up. You've got to lock me up before the full moon. And he's just really frenzied as a man trying to get people to take him seriously, that he is in fact going to change into a wolf. And then we get to see that. And it's just truly, truly remarkable. And then on top of that, the actor who is portraying Count Dracula in this film, whose name is Duncan, I'm never going to be able to, I believe it's Duncan Rager. His Dracula has actually been ranked as one of the best portrayals of the character in all of cinema. And he doesn't say a lot throughout the course of the movie, but he does have one just, it's a line that no matter who you are and no matter what your stance on how much you like kids or not, will really bother you because he calls a five-year-old a bitch.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, dude. Not cool. Like, I know you're Dracula and that you kill people, and we're not cool with that either, but that's really ice cold in a way that's very uncomfortable, even to this day as I watch it. Like, it really makes me uncomfortable that he calls that little girl a bitch.
Well, he's decidedly evil.
Yes.
Like, he's not seductive Dracula.
No, the sexy's kind of been pulled out of this portrayal.
Yeah, no, he is just this kind of wicked... disgusting, you know, debonair monster, but someone who has no qualms about killing kids.
At all.
No, he sends Frankenstein's monster to go kill a bunch of kids. Get me that book back and kill the kids.
All of them. Kill all the kids.
Yeah, he's not a good dude. And he also has the slowest vampire thralls of all time. like, it's a great portrayal, but in terms of monster physics, I do it's been the one thing that's always bugged me about Monster Squad, even since when I was a kid. It's like, why are the vampiric thrall girls zombies? Why are they shambling and don't actually do anything except stand there and look pretty and hiss a lot? Like, that's, they just exist to walk slow so we can fire stakes through their hearts.
This is true. This is very true. It is definitely a problem. You want to have a more
dynamic.
Yeah, at least a more efficient group of, you know, your vampire.
If we're going to turn Rudy into the Legolas of this movie,
yes,
let's make him look slightly more badass than just shooting at shambling women.
And that's one of the other things I really like about Monster Squad in terms of what we were talking about before, with it kind of being from the kids' perspective and giving us a more dangerous portrayal of kids as they really are, is that it undercuts what I feel like is perceived as the stuffiness of a lot of Universal Monster Hammer type films. Right from the opening crawl, where there's this very sort of grandiose, almost poetic words on the screen that are telling us that, you know, Van Helsing tries to stop the evil Dracula, blah, blah. And the last line is,
They blew it,
which is so how a kid would describe the events of the opening of this film, which, by the way, we talked about Shane Black's original screenplay. Apparently, the original opening was going to have all of these mounted soldiers on horseback, and Van Helsing was going to have a fleet of Zeppelins, and like, it was apparently going to be more expensive to shoot that scene than they spent on the entirety of Monster Squad as it is. So I'm with you. I'd really like to read that script at some point. Now, moving on to the question of sort of the effects and the production value, this is another place where I feel like these films are very neck and neck. Because on the one hand, in Monster Squad, we have an amazing werewolf transformation sequence. We also have a scene where the werewolf is blown apart and then reforms, which is something I've never seen in any werewolf movie. And then just the outstanding makeup work done on Tom Noonan to be Frankenstein's monster, and just a lot of really great. I mean, there are
the monster design of this, right down to their redesign of the creature. Black Lagoon.
Oh my gosh,
the way the mummy looks. Mm-hmm. There's the great bit when the mummy gets unraveled and you see the skull, and the skull, it could have just been a skull, but no, it's this mangled, kind of almost withered, like gross looking skull, like something was wrong with this thing to begin with. It's just gnarly, and all of this creature design work and makeup work is just really, really great.
Yeah.
Although what Goonies has in its place is Goonies has amazing production design when it comes to sets.
Yes. The production designer, if I recall correctly, was J. Michael Riva, who has worked on so many incredible films. One of them, another JFC alum, Tango and Cash.
Tango.
Cash. The pirate ship is sort of the crown jewel of the production of Goonies. That thing they built. They actually built a whole fucking pirate ship. It's enormous. So much so that they were very proud of it, and when the production wrapped, they tried desperately to get someone, cast, staff, somebody to actually take that thing home, but it was too big, so they had to scrap it. But I mean, between that and I love the design of the Rube Goldberg machines all throughout this movie.
Oh, speaking, and since we're kind of in this vein, speaking of things that were cut, they cut something big from this movie as well. There was a giant octopus scene.
Which, if you watch Goonies and watch the end of the movie, Data still says to the reporter when he asks him what did you guys go through? What's going on? The first thing out of Data's mouth, the octopus was the scariest part. That remains in the theatrical cut of the film. And for years, audiences were like, what the fuck is he talking about?
It's just had this whole big adventure and he tells a lie at first.
There's a song on the soundtrack about, I think it's called like Eight Arms to Hold You With or something, that was specifically supposed to be a reference to that octopus, but they left it in the soundtrack.
Also the name of your first sex tape.
Yes, and also the working title of Richard Lester, who would direct Superman 2, Help. It was the working title of Help. Was like, I think it was Eight Arms to Hold You With, and yes, it is the title of my hentai porn tape. Don't worry about it. But yeah, so both of these films have pretty amazing effects, pretty amazing production design, and I think it's direly important because, again, you're having children carrying the bulk of both of these movies, and you have to make the world that they exist in feel real, especially if they're going to some fantastical places, or in the case of Monster Squad, in sort of an urban myth or an urban fairy tale type of way, bringing the fantastical into the modern world. You have to make those things feel realized. You have to make them feel like they are lived in, and that the threats are very real. And I feel like that is why both of these films are very neck and neck, because they use the resources that they use, the tools that they have, and the manpower that they have to create two very distinct, very real worlds, very tangible worlds. Whether you're going through the caves of, you know, trying to find One-Eyed Willie's treasure, or you are in the most idyllic of suburban neighborhoods that is suddenly rampaged by monsters, and there's a vortex in the sky, and you're reading, you know, from an ancient German book, trying to seal it. I mean, like, these things have to feel like they exist for the characters, because if they feel phony to them, they're going to feel doubly phony to us. And I think that's both of these films just kind of knocking out of the park when it comes to that. And finally, we get to, we've kind of touched upon it a little, but the category I think makes all the difference in the world is the idea of what's at stake. In both of these films, I mean, in any story, you know, the stakes for the characters is what drives everything. But in the case of the Goonies, in the case of Monster Squad, if these kids fail, the world ends. In the case of the Goonies, if they fail, they have to move to a different town.
They lose their home.
They lose their home. So, I mean, when you say it like that, and when you look at it that way, that might initially read as a knock against Goonies, but there's an argument to be made that it actually makes Goonies the more relatable and therefore the more timeless film.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing about Goonies is the stakes are much more personal.
Yes.
It's not, we have to stop this, you know, or else the world will end. We don't know what that means.
Right.
You know, what does a Dracula-ruled world, you know, look like? But what, you know, with Goonies, we know what it's like to lose our home and lose our friends.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
That's a very real thing. And that's something that in childhood means the world. I mean, I related this film quite a bit. I was a military brat.
So you moved a lot.
I moved every 3 to 4 years, and I would pick up and started a new school with new friends and new, you know, a new environment. And fortunately for me, when you're a military brat, all the other kids you're spending time around are military brats too. So they're all very used to having to make new friends as well. So you show up on the first day of school and walk up and talk to people, and there's your new group of friends, because that's just the way it works in the military. But it's really hard when you have to leave, because it's like, damn it, I've finally gotten all this here. I've got all these friends. I know where everything is. This place is awesome. Why would I want to leave? And then you have to pick up and go and start all over again. And this movie really connected with me in a very personal way, because that fear for those kids is legitimate. Like, that is the changing of their world in the exact same way that a Dracula-ruled world might be.
Yeah.
Although, with the stakes with Monster Squad, they've always got the army showing up to help out, because Eugene wrote an excellent letter.
That's true. But my favorite part of that is they show up after the kids have already handled it.
Oh, yeah, they're like, who's Eugene? Yeah, dear army guys, there are monsters. Please come, Eugene. And sure enough, they send the army. If only we knew it were that easy.
Yeah, right?
Dear army guys, we're running low on coffee. Please help.
Dear
Signed,
army guys,
Junk Food Cinema.
I could really use a grand slam, bacon well done, eggs over easy. If you could, it's direly
and
important.
Bring me a Moons Over My Hammy.
Yes. Yeah, Cargo would like a Moons Over My Hammy. We are at Hunger Def Con 4 or 1. I don't know how that works. But the point is, we're at the
worst. I can't
worst,
believe
worst
we're talking about calling the army and you ordered Denny's.
Mm.
Like, that is just so your fucking thing.
You're welcome. Actually, it'd be Jim's. I mean, let's be real.
Of course it would be Jim's.
It would not be Denny's. It would be Jim's.
A cowboy waffle and 2 breakfast tacos.
Aha. But we're not even to the junk food pairing. But this is actually a very apt metaphor, because I didn't go with Jim's because I figured that not enough people listening would know what Jim's was, even though Jim's
is just as
tasty.
Even though we've talked about Jim's like about 30 trillion times on
this show. Jim's is just as delicious, maybe even more so than Denny's, but I knew that far more people...
How dare you say just as delicious? It surpasses Denny's in every way, and you know it.
See, but this is what I'm saying. More people know Denny's, so they would understand the reference.
Yeah.
And again, more people know Goonies, but when you break these
There are people
films
out
down,
there going, what is a cowboy waffle?
Yeah, they probably think it's something
filthy.
And that
breaks my heart.
Probably think it's something just absolutely filthy.
It's a waffle with a cowboy on it. That's actually what it is.
That's
it's
true.
A really good waffle.
It's exactly what it sounds like it is. The plot points of Monster Squad are entirely supernatural, but the events experienced by the Goonies themselves don't extend to that height of fantastic. They're like extra natural more than supernatural, because it's like, yeah, you're dealing with pirate ships, you're dealing with gangsters. There really were pirates. There, you know, there really are relics that you can find that are worth a lot of money, and there really are, you know, there really was organized crime. So it's like, they're...
Goonies is a lot more grounded despite being so fanciful.
Yeah, exactly, because all of the things that they deal with are unlikely.
Pirates in Oregon?
Pirates in Oregon with booby traps that happen to be under a gangster's hideout, then the gangster's dressed like that's from the 40s.
$50 bill.
But $50 bill! But not impossible. Not fantastical to the point of being entirely supernatural, which is why I just called it extra natural, which is what's going
on.
You
also called it booby traps instead of booty traps.
Booty traps. That's what I said!
That is the one movie quote I'm not allowed to ever make. I make it and my wife gives me the ugliest look. She loves the Goonies, but she hates the booty trap joke. And
I'm glad to know that, because I will lift that burden off your shoulders, and that I will make that reference every time I'm around her.
But whatever, yeah, no, because what'll happen is she'll say I'll say something, and she'll correct me in some way, but it'll be where she's correcting me to say whatever I actually was saying to begin with, and I just get, that's what I said, booty twap. And
you sound like Tweety Bird, like, which is great because it's not even racist, it's just inaccurate. Sounds like Tweety Bird.
My impressions are not good. I do three impressions that I do decently to amazingly, and everything else I bork. My French sounds like Russian. My Russian sounds like French Canadian.
Which is only a problem when you're ordering salad dressing, but it is a problem in that particular circumstance. Yeah. So, but one other thing, we've talked a lot about nostalgia when we're talking about the two filmmakers in this, but I want to talk about nostalgia when it comes to how we see these movies, because I have a very interesting set of circumstances in that I saw Goonies as a kid. I saw it one summer probably every single day. I loved it since the time I was old enough to understand what a movie was. I mean, you have to understand, it came out a year after I was fucking born. However, Monster Squad, I didn't discover until I moved to Austin. I did not know that movie existed. They did a reunion screening at the Draft House.
Yep.
And I believe this had been after...
Someone we know went out with the little girl from the movie.
Yeah. Odd. And then I think this was just after the Night of the Creeps retrospective screening, which is where I saw that.
Because they were doing
time.
A Deckerthon.
Right. And so the cast was
Did they
show
three movies?
I think they just showed those two.
So it was a double decker instead of a triple decker.
That's two puns for you in one show.
There's actually
what is
three.
Happening
you missed
right
the
now?
Other one.
I missed the other one, apparently. Wow. Wow, I missed a pun. I'm going to have to go back when I'm editing this and find it. I discovered Monster Squad as an adult. But as an adult who was also starting to like fall head over heels in love with the Universal Monsters and, you know, a lot of movies of the 80s that I'd missed out on. So it, for different reasons, also hit me at the perfect time. Goonies hit me at the perfect time to really tap into, you know, all of the things that I loved as a kid and all the like adventures I wanted to go on with my friends. And Monster Squad hit me because I was starting to get nostalgic for the 80s, for my youth, and also just ravenously consuming anything from that decade that I hadn't previously had experience with. So it's weird that I tend to lean a little bit more toward Monster Squad, even though I'm have more of a nostalgic link to the Goonies. So I was interested, Cargo, did you see both of these movies as a kid?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I saw Goonies in a theater. And then multiple times on VHS. Saw Monster Squad the first time on VHS. I wish I'd seen it in a theater. But it was me and my parents always had a Saturday night movie night. And this was one of our movie nights. And I remember I picked this movie because I really wanted to see it. And it was a perfect 80s family movie. It was, I mean, the big problem that movie has is it's PG-13.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, the swearing and the violence, you know, because they do blow up the Wolfman. And the Wolfman does... form back together, and we do blow the chest open of the creature from the Black Lagoon.
They kill a cop.
They kill several cops.
They blow up the dad's partner in a car. And that's the other thing I love.
The monsters throw around and kill and snap the necks of several police officers.
Yeah.
Like, it's like they see a police officer and they're like, oh, you're fodder, I'll kill you. But kids, I'm going to give you time to shoot me. And yet we don't care because the kids get a great, here's what Monster Squad does better than the Goonies does. Monster Squad's got better Shane Black one-liners.
Where you going, Rudy?
I'm in the goddamn club, aren't I?
Yeah. No, that I'm like, Rudy, where are you going? It's like, I'm part of the goddamn club, aren't I? My name is Horace. Wolfman's got Nards. Like, every time there's some great beat, there's some great, tag to go with it. Hell, even the partner that gets blown up, he has the same joke that he does three times during the movie. I told you I'm a good cop, joking about whenever he notices something obvious. The script for Monster Squad is so much sharper. But in true to form, the script for Goonies is so much more heartfelt, which is something that even in his worst movies, Chris Columbus is great at. He's always got heart.
For sure.
He always connects with the characters. Earlier when I said the worst of the Harry Potter movies, that's still pretty goddamn good.
Yeah.
His later films sadly fell off.
But you're right. Like in the Goonies, like your heart goes out to these kids for having to. Like they're just what they say and the way it's structured. You feel bad for them having to leave their friends, and you feel like this tremendous sense of loss for them having to move out of their homes. Like that has a lot of weight and impact. And then I will say this though: in Monster Squad, it's not delved into as deeply or as dramatically as the loss of the homes in the Goonies. But his parents are going through some shit.
Oh yeah,
like they have an argument about how his dad, who's a cop, And when I say his dad, I'm talking about the main character of the film, Sean. His dad is one of the local cops and misses a couple's counseling session because he's on a case. And it's clear. And that feels to me weirdly like another Spielberg moment, because Spielberg loves to, when I talked about the responsibilities of adulthood that he thrust upon the shoulders of children characters. I mean, it's a lot like in E.T. when Elliot's going through his parents' divorce and you feel that. There is that little almost Spielberg nugget in the Monster Squad of Sean's parents are clearly going through some serious troubles.
Well, and true to form, Shane Black turns that on its ear and creates a really wonderful, truthful, awkward moment when mom is tucking, her daughter into bed, and she's scared because her brother told her that thunderstorms when the monsters come out and scared him. And then she goes to walk out and goes, are you going to yell at him? And she goes, honey, I love your father very much. And the little girl's like, what?
I meant Sean.
I meant Sean for scaring me. And
yeah.
Mom's just like, oh.
Yeah.
And it's just that, oh, fuck, you, yeah. And it's just so elegant how that's done in that movie. But there are other really great little truthful moments
in the Goonies.
In the Goonies that are even more powerfully human.
Oh, Sean Astin. It's funny that the lead character name is Sean in one, and the actor who plays the lead character in the other is named Sean.
Yeah, that's actually been throwing me this whole time. That's why I've been avoiding using those.
Sean Astin has that whole speech when they're in the well.
Oh, yeah.
And they're about to get out, and he's
it's our time
down here.
Don't you realize? The next time you see Sky, it'll be over another town. The next time you take a test, it'll be in some other school. Our parents, they want the best of stuff for us. But right now they gotta do what's right for them. Cause it's their time. Their time. Up there. Down here, it's our time. It's our time down here.
But then there's these great small moments like, okay, that's little boy's room, that's little girl's room. And then, you know,
Josh Brolin's
walking
room.
Off and he's like, this is the men's room. And then all the other guys go over to the men's room. Like, it's such a kid moment. Like, mm-hmm. It's like we all, you know, when we were kids, we all wanted to be older. We wanted to be respected. We wanted to be
cooler. Because it's no country for little men.
Like, it didn't matter where they were peeing, but they wanted to pee where it was called the men's room and where the big boy was peeing. Like, it's like there's so much raw childhood truth to that movie that Monster Squad doesn't have, but Monster Squad is much sharper, much funnier in terms of its comedy and its dialogue. And it's so Goonies is so cinematic in a Spielbergian way, and Monster Squad is so cinematic in a action movie way. Like, it is, like, you see
in a Shane Black
all over that. And it's funny because, you know, Richard Donner would go on to, you know, while this movie was being made, Richard Donner was making Lethal Weapon.
Right.
So
with Shane Black's script.
So, but you could really see the action movie writer here in this script, even though it's a kid's film. And so they're so close and yet so far away in so many ways. It's why, you know, it's very easy to call Monster Squad a knockoff or a facsimile. And I'm certain there are aspects to it that they were like, hey, this worked in Goonies, so let's do this here. But it altogether becomes its own beast and its own kind of movie. Like, Decker never apes Donner. He does his own thing and is aping his own nostalgia. And again, what Decker does well is between this and Night of the Creeps is he takes these things that inspired him as a kid from a different era and translates it into 80s cinema and has its own look and feel that feels nostalgic, but he's not just ripping off shots or trying to recreate a 50s monster movie or a 30s monster movie. He's creating his own variant of it. And I think ultimately he makes his own kids movie version of the Abbott and Costello horror movies.
So we've gone through all these categories. We've looked at this very analytically. We've tallied up the scores. We've run it through our supercomputer. And we have come to a conclusion. It doesn't fucking matter. Now, I apologize for the ruse. I apologize for the third act twist of this episode. But there is no reason to pick a winner in this debate because it's not even really a debate. Instead, we should be marveling at the fact that both of these films exist. And you could sit there and you can say that one ripped off the other. But as we've broken it down for you, there is so much shared heritage in these two films with all of the collective creators who had worked together prior to this, who would work together after this, that really this isn't about one film ripping off another or even either film ripping off what came before it. This is more akin to how twins are formed in the womb. These are zygotes with so much shared genetic material breaking off and becoming their own things that, yes, are going to share a lot of similarities because of all of that DNA that they share from way before they ever were formed. And I feel like it brings us to the junk food pairing in a really beautiful way.
Before that, I want to ask a sudden death question. Sudden death question.
But do you agree with me, though?
Oh, I do.
There's like, no reason to pick a winner.
No. I think these movies are I think they're peas and carrots, peanut butter and jelly. They go great together. They make a wonderful double feature.
Boom.
But sudden death question. So let's, now that we've copped out.
Yes, totally.
I'm going to need a definitive answer here. Best villain aligned monster that turns into the kid's best friend, Frank or Sloth?
Ooh, you're asking me to choose between John Matuszak and Tom Noonan.
Yeah. Frank or Sloth?
Oh my God. The makeup's so much better on Frank. And he's so much sweeter. I'm going to go with Frank.
You're going to go with Frank?
For one reason and one reason only. That final moment of Frank when she throws him the teddy bear and disappears into the vortex is fucking gut-wrenching. Absolutely gut-wrenching. And I tear up every time I see it. Therefore, I got to go with Frank.
Okay. I've got to... I actually have to do Sloth.
Damn it, Cargill!
No, I can't agree with you.
Civil War!
It's...
Line in the sand!
Yeah, no. Sloth... I think Sloth... is the funnier character. And as much as that moment when Frank goes and Frank flies into limbo is a great moment, I think the moment that's slightly better is, hey, you guys, when Sloth turns and swings in and becomes Errol Flynn. That moment is amazing. Like, that's a great moment. And of course, he has the better catchphrase.
Which one?
Sloth love chunk.
Sloth love chunk. But I'm sorry, when Frank says bogus, come on.
I choose Sloth loves chunk over bogus.
But hey, you guys, is followed by a moment where Richard Donner puts his own dick on the table when Sloth rips his shirt off and he's wearing a Superman t-shirt underneath.
Yeah.
It's like, Donner, we know you directed Superman. We get it. But no, you know what? I think that's completely valid. I think, again, we are splitting so many hairs, and ultimately,
it comes down to our junk food pairing.
Just love both. And that leads us entirely into the junk food pairing, which I have gone with Austin barbecue. Now, living in Austin for quite some time, I've noticed that for many people, barbecue favoritism is not a matter of simple preference. It's
religion.
It's a religion. It's an allegiance that's vehemently defended. I mean, I love Franklin's meets fuck Franklin's head on. While other people believe that you can either eat at the Salt Lick or you can fornicate yourself with a meat thermometer. Like camps form and borders are formed around those camps.
Why would you eat at the Salt Lick if you're not a tourist? Why would you do that?
See, but
why would you do that when Terry Black's is a thing?
Blacks and Smitty's out in Lockhart. Another thing, people are just so like, I am a Smitty's or I'm a... It's like
I mean, Mann's is out of business.
Oh, that's
Christ's
so sad.
Sake.
That's so
it's
sad.
It's depressing.
It's very sad. It's like partisan politics, and I don't understand that. Why? This acrimony is not only pointless, it's self-defeating. I mean, why limit yourself to one selection when you exist in a world of innumerable options? What I found...
Except the Salt Lick.
Okay. What I found with Austin Barbecue is that...
I'm going to get a letter.
You are going to get a letter from the Salt Lick. It's written by a cow. What I found is that much as we've determined about these two movies, you can pick and choose among all of the barbecue establishments the elements of each restaurant that does that thing. That's what I found is every barbecue place in Austin does one thing better than everybody else.
Oh, yeah.
But the overall effect is that there are so many great options and there's not really a bad place to go to. There are so many great options. Why not celebrate that fact and, you know, do something different every night of the week? Why not do the double-decker double feature that we talked about, which would be, you know, it's not technically a double-decker, but I really just love calling it a double-decker double feature of Goonies and Monster Squad. Watch them both.
No, the double-decker would be...
Monster Squad and Night of the Creeps.
Yeah.
For sure. But do the double feature. Watch both of them. And I think the argument to end this argument forever, there is an actor who was in both of these films.
Yeah.
And that actor played the same character in both of these films. Mary Ellen Trainer plays the mother of the main sibling children in both of these fucking movies, guys. Mm-hmm. Two films share one mother. I can't think of a more beautiful metaphor for why the
mother of two Shawns.
She's the mother of two Shawns. Do you people understand? She is the mother of two Shawns. We need to put away our weapons and just love both of these movies because they are both outstanding. They both hit upon so many things that we loved as kids that translate into our adult years and make them endlessly revisitable every single year of my life. Absolutely. Austin, get a big plate of Austin barbecue from several different places. That's right. Go everywhere.
Try them all. Just remember that unless you're President Obama, you don't get to cut in line at Franklin's.
That is entirely
Even
true.
Kanye got turned away from Franklin's for trying to cut in line.
That's true.
But Obama gets to cut in line.
Well, I hope so.
I mean, well, no. I mean, hilariously, that was the one day where, you know, somebody at the end of the line got there and found out that everything was gone and actually got to...
Thanks, Obama.
Thanks, Obama.
I love it.
I waited in line and I didn't get anything today because the fucking president cut.
Midnight in the world, remember?
Don't say that. Never say that. Goonies never say die.
Well, thank you for joining us on this ultimately probably very libertarian view of Monster Squad versus Goonies. We didn't vote straight ticket on either of these.
I don't think you can.
And what we've come to learn is that they are both outstanding films, and this crazy conflict of fandom is pointless, guys. watch both of them, enjoy both of them, and enjoy more of Junk Food Cinema on iTunes and Stitcher. All of our back cataloged episodes are there. If you would like to follow us on Twitter, we're at Junk Food Cinema, and on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargo, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook at facebook.com/massaworm.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And I also want to let you guys know that every Thursday, this is a new thing. There is a website that I helped found. OneOfUs.net is doing a live show at Mr. Tramp's here in Austin at 11:30 p.m. on Thursdays. If you are not in Austin or can't make it out that far past your bedtime, it is actually live streamed on Mr. Tramp's Ustream. So check that out. We'll have links all over the place, but just a little plug for myself, if I might.
You didn't tell me about this.
Yeah. It's a live show. We just did the first one last week, and just live podcasting, live nerddom, pretty much exactly what you would expect from any time myself and Christopher Cox are on the mic together. So that's happening every Thursday at 11:30 p.m. from Mr. Tramps. So, yeah, definitely check that out. So, yeah, we're going to leave you. And again, I just want to say, give peace a chance when it comes to these two films. Watch them both together. And always remember that the only way to defeat a wolfman is, Cargill,
To shoot him with a silver bullet?
Yeah, but that's not quite what I was thinking.